Behold, Zarathustra, even the people learn from thee and acquire faith in thy teaching. But for them to believe fully in thee, one thing is still needful. Thou must first of all convince us cripples. Here hast thou now a fine selection, and verily, an opportunity with more than one forelock. The blind canst thou heal and make the lame run, and from him who hath too much behind couldst thou well also take away a little. That, I think, would be the right method to make the cripples believe in Zarathustra. Zarathustra, however, answered thus unto him who so spake, When one taketh his hump from the hunchback, then doth one take from him his spirit. So do the people teach. And when one giveth the blind man eyes, then doth he see too many bad things on the earth, so that he curseth him who healed him. He, however, who maketh the lame man run, inflicteth upon him the greatest injury. For hardly can he run, when his vices run away with him. So do the people teach concerning cripples. And why should not Zarathustra also learn from the people, when the people learn from Zarathustra? It is, however, the smallest thing unto me, since I have been amongst men, to see one person lacking an eye, another an ear, and a third a leg, and that others have lost the tongue, or the nose, or the head. I see and have seen worse things, and diverse things so hideous, that I should neither like to speak of all matters, nor even keep silent about some of them, namely, men who lack everything, except that they have too much of one thing, men who are nothing more than a big eye, or a big mouth, or a big belly, or something else big, reversed cripples, I call such men. And when I came out of my solitude, and for the first time passed over this bridge, then I could not trust mine eyes, but looked again and again, and said at last, That is an ear as big as a man. I looked still more attentively, and actually there did move under the ear something that was pitiably small and poor and slim, and in truth this immense ear was perched on a small thin stalk. The stalk, however, was a man. A person, putting a glass to his eyes, could even recognize further a small, envious countenance, and also that a bloated sulet dangled at the stalk. The people told me, however, that the big ear was not only a man, but a great man, a genius. But I never believed in the people when they spake of great men, and I hold to my belief that it was a reversed cripple who had too little of everything, and too much of one thing. When Zarathustra had spoken thus unto the hunchback, and unto those of whom the hunchback was the mouthpiece and advocate, then did he turn to his disciples in profound dejection, and said, Verily, my friends, I walk amongst men as amongst the fragments and limbs of human beings. This is the terrible thing to mine eye, that I find man broken up and scattered about, as on a battle and butcher ground. And when my eye fleeth from the present to the bygone, it findeth ever the same, fragments and limbs and fearful chances, but no men. The present and the bygone upon earth, ah, my friends, that is my most unbearable trouble, and I should not know how to live if I were not a seer of what is to come. A seer, a purposer, a creator, a future itself, and a bridge to the future, and alas, also, as it were, a cripple on this bridge, all that is Zarathustra. And ye also asked yourselves often, Who is Zarathustra to us? What shall he be called by us? And like me, did ye give yourselves questions for answers? Is he a promiser or a fulfiller? A conqueror or an inheritor? A harvest or a plowshare? A physician or a healed one? Is he a poet, or a genuine one, an emancipator, or a subjugator, a good one, or an evil one? I walk amongst men as the fragments of the future, that future which I contemplate. And it is all my poetization and aspiration to compose and collect into unity what is fragment and riddle and fearful chance. And how could I endure to be a man, if man were not also the composer and riddle-reader and redeemer of chance? To redeem what is past, and to transform every it was into thus would I have it, that only do I call redemption. will, so is the emancipator and joy-bringer called. Thus have I taught you, my friends. But now learn this, likewise. The will itself is still a prisoner. Willing emancipateth, but what is that called which still putteth the emancipator in chains? It was. Thus is the will's teeth-gnashing and lonesomest tribulation called. Impotent towards what hath been done, it is a malicious spectator of all that is past. Not backward can the will, that it cannot break time and time's desire, that is the will's lonesomest tribulation. Willing emancipateth. What doth willing itself devise in order to get free from its tribulation and mock at its prison? Ah, a fool becometh every prisoner. Foolishly delivereth itself also the imprisoned will. That time doth not run backward, that is its animosity. That which was, so is the stone which it cannot roll, called. And thus doth it roll stones out of animosity and ill-humour, and taketh revenge on whatever doth not, like it, feel rage and ill-humour. Thus did the will, the emancipator, become a torturer, and on all that is capable of suffering it taketh revenge, because it cannot go backward. This, yea, this alone is revenge itself, the will's antipathy to time, and its it was. Verily a great folly dwelleth in our will, and it became a curse unto all humanity that this folly acquired spirit. The spirit of revenge, my friends, that hath hitherto been man's best contemplation, and where there was suffering it was claimed there was always penalty. Penalty, so calleth itself revenge. With a lying word it feigneth a good conscience. And because in the willer himself there is suffering, because he cannot will backwards, thus was willing itself, and all life claimed, to be penalty. And then did cloud after cloud roll over the spirit, until at last madness preached, everything perisheth, therefore everything deserveth to perish. And this itself is justice, the law of time, that he must devour his children. Thus did madness preach. Morally are things ordered according to justice and penalty. Oh, where is there deliverance from the flux of things and from the existence of penalty? Thus did madness preach. Can there be deliverance when there is eternal justice? Alas, unrollable is the stone it was. Eternal must also be all penalties. Thus did madness preach. No deed can be annihilated. How could it be undone by the penalty? This is what is eternal in the existence of penalty. That existence also must be eternally recurring deed and guilt. Unless the will should at last deliver itself, and willing become non-willing. But ye know, my brethren, this fabulous song of madness. Away from those fabulous songs did I lead you when I taught you the will is a creator. All it was is a fragment, a riddle, a fearful chance, until the creating will saith thereto, but thus would I have it. Until the creating will saith thereto, but thus do I will it, thus shall I will it. But did it ever speak thus? And when doth this take place? Hath the will been unharnessed from its own folly? Hath the will become its own deliverer and joy-bringer? Hath it unlearned the spirit of revenge and all teeth-gnashing? And who hath taught it reconciliation with time, and something higher than all reconciliation? Something higher than all reconciliation must the will, which is the will to power. But how doth that take place? Who hath taught it also to will backwards? But at this point in his discourse, it chanced that Zarathustra suddenly paused, and looked like a person in the greatest alarm. With terror in his eyes did he gaze on his disciples. His glances pierced, as with arrows, their thoughts and arrear thoughts, but after a brief space he again laughed, and said soothedly, "It is difficult to live amongst men, because silence is so difficult, especially for a babbler." Thus spake Zarathustra. The hunchback, however, had listened to the conversation and had covered his face during the time. But when he heard Zarathustra laugh, he looked up with curiosity and said slowly, "But why doth Zarathustra speak otherwise unto us than unto his disciples?" Zarathustra answered, "What is there to be wondered at? With hunchbacks one may well speak in a hunchbacked way." "Very good," said the hunchback, "and with pupils one may well tell tales out of school. But why doth Zarathustra speak otherwise unto his pupils than unto himself?" 43. Manly prudence. Not the height, it is the declivity that is terrible. The declivity, where the gaze shooteth downwards and the hand graspeth upwards, there doth the heart become giddy through its double will. Ah, friends, do ye divine also my heart's double will? This is my declivity and my danger, that my gaze shooteth towards the summit, and my hand would fain clutch and lean on the depth. To man clingeth my will, with chains do I bind myself to man, because I am pulled upwards to the Superman, for thither doth mine other will tend. And therefore do I live blindly among men, as if I knew them not, that my hand may not entirely lose belief in firmness. I know not, you men, this gloom and consolation is often spread around me. I sit at the gateway for every rogue and ask, "Who wisheth to deceive me?" This is my first manly prudence, that I allow myself to be deceived, so as not to be on my guard against deceivers. Ah, if I were on my guard against man, how could man be an anchor to my ball? Too easily would I be pulled upwards and away. This providence is over my fate, that I have to be without foresight. And he who would not languish amongst men must learn to drink out of all glasses, and he who would keep clean amongst men must know how to wash himself even with dirty water. And thus spake I often to myself for consolation, "Courage, cheer up, old heart, an unhappiness hath failed to befall thee. Enjoy that as thy happiness." This, however, is mine other manly prudence. I am more forbearing to the vain than to the proud. Is not wounded vanity the mother of all tragedies? Where, however, pride is wounded, there groweth up something better than pride. That life may be fair to behold, its game must be well played. For that purpose, however, it needeth good actors. Good actors have I found all the vain ones. They play and wish people to be fond of beholding them. All their spirit is in this wish. They represent themselves, they invent themselves. In their neighbourhood I like to look upon life. It cureth of melancholy. Therefore am I forbearing to the vain, because they are the physicians of my melancholy, and keep me attached to man as to a drama. And further, who conceiveth the full depth of the modesty of the vain man? I am favourable to him and sympathetic on account of his modesty. From you would he learn his belief in himself. He feedeth upon your glances. He eateth praise out of your hands. Your lies doth he even believe when you lie favourably about him, for in its depths sigheth his heart, "What am I?" And if that be the true virtue which is unconscious of itself, well, the vain man is unconscious of his modesty. This is, however, my third manly prudence. I am not put out of conceit with the wicked by your timorousness. I am happy to see the marvels the warm sun hatcheth, tigers and palms and rattlesnakes. Also amongst men there is a beautiful brood of the warm sun, and much that is marvellous in the wicked. In truth, as your wisest did not seem to me so very wise, so found I also human wickedness below the fame of it. And oft did I ask with a shake of the head, "Why still rattle, ye rattlesnakes?" Verily, there is still a future even for evil, and the warmest south is still undiscovered by man. How many things are now called the worst wickedness, which are only 12 feet broad and 3 months long. Some day, however, will greater dragons come into the world. For that the Superman may not lack his dragon, the super dragon that is worthy of him, there must still much warm sun glow on moist virgin forests. Out of your wild cats must tigers have evolved, and out of your poison toads, crocodiles, for the good hunter shall have a good hunt. And verily, ye good and just, in you there is much to be laughed at, and especially your fear of what hath hitherto been called the devil. So alien are ye in your souls to what is great, that to you the Superman would be frightful in his goodness. And ye wise and knowing ones, ye would flee from the solar glow of the wisdom in which the Superman joyfully batheth his nakedness. Ye highest men who have come within my ken, this is my doubt of you, and my secret laughter. I suspect you would call my Superman a devil. Ah, I became tired of those highest and best ones. From their height did I long to be up, out and away to the Superman. A horror came over me when I saw those best ones naked. Then there grew for me the pinions to soar away into distant futures. Into more distant futures, into more southern souths than ever artist dreamed of thither, where gods are ashamed of all clothes. But disguised do I want to see you, ye neighbours and fellow men, and well attired and vain and estimable, as the good and just. And disguised will I myself sit amongst you, that I may mistake you and myself, for that is my last manly prudence. Thus spake Zarathustra. 44. The Stillest Hour. What hath happened unto me, my friends? Ye see me troubled, driven forth, unwillingly obedient, ready to go, alas, to go away from you. Yea, once more must Zarathustra retire to his solitude, but unjoyously this time doth the bear go back to his cave. What hath happened unto me? Who ordereth this? Ah, mine angry mistress wisheth it so. She spake unto me. Have I ever named her name to you? Yesterday, towards evening, there spake unto me my stillest hour. That is the name of my terrible mistress. And thus did it happen. For everything must I tell you, that your heart may not harden against the suddenly departing one. Do ye know the terror of him who falleth asleep? To the very toes is he terrified, because the ground giveth way under him, and the dream beginneth. This do I speak unto you in parable. Yesterday at the stillest hour did the ground give way under me. The dream began. The hour hand moved on. The timepiece of my life drew breath. Never did I hear such stillness around me, so that my heart was terrified. Then was there spoken unto me without voice, Thou knowest it, Zarathustra. And I cried in terror at this whispering, and the blood left my face, but I was silent. Then was there once more spoken unto me without voice, Thou knowest it, Zarathustra, but thou dost not speak it. And at last I answered like one defiant, Yea, I know it, but I will not speak it. Then was there again spoken unto me without voice, Thou wilt not, Zarathustra? Is this true? Conceal thyself not behind thy defiance. And I wept and trembled like a child and said, Ah, I would indeed, but how can I do it? Exempt me only from this. It is beyond my power. Then was there again spoken unto me without voice, What matter about thyself, Zarathustra? Speak thy word and succumb. And I answered, Ah, is it my word? Who am I? I await the worthier one. I am not worthy even to succumb by it. Then was there again spoken unto me without voice, What matter about thyself? Thou art not yet humble enough for me. Humility hath the hardest skin. And I answered, What hath not the skin of my humility endured? At the foot of my height do I dwell. How high are my summits? No one hath yet told me, but well do I know my valleys. Then was there again spoken unto me without voice, O Zarathustra, he who hath to remove mountains removeth also valleys and plains. And I answered, As yet hath my word not removed mountains, and what I have spoken hath not reached men. I went indeed unto men, but not yet have I attained unto them. Then was there again spoken unto me without voice, What knowest thou thereof? The dew falleth on the grass when the night is most silent. And I answered, They mocked me when I found and walked in mine own path, and certainly did my feet then tremble. And thus did they speak unto me, Thou forgottest the path before, now dost thou also forget how to walk. Then was there again spoken unto me without voice, What matter about their mockery? Thou art one who hast unlearned to obey. Now shalt thou command. Knowest thou not who is most needed by all? He who commandeth great things. To execute great things is difficult, but the more difficult task is to command great things. This is thy most unpardonable obstinacy. Thou hast the power, and thou wilt not rule. And I answered, I lack the lion's voice for all commanding. Then was there again spoken unto me as a whispering, It is the stillest words which bring the storm. Thoughts that come with dove's footsteps guide the world. O Zarathustra, thou shalt go as a shadow of that which is to come. Thus wilt thou command, and in commanding go foremost. And I answered, I am ashamed. Then was there again spoken unto me without voice, Thou must yet become a child, and be without shame. The pride of youth is still upon thee. Late hast thou become young, but he who would become a child must surmount even his youth. And I considered a long while and trembled. At last, however, did I say what I had said at first, I will not. Then did a laughing take place all around me. Alas, how that laughing lacerated my bowels and cut into my heart. And there was spoken unto me for the last time, O Zarathustra, thy fruits are ripe, but thou art not ripe for thy fruits. So must thou go again into solitude, for thou shalt yet become mellow. And again was there a laughing, and it fled. Then did it become still around me, as with a double stillness. I lay, however, on the ground, and the sweat flowed from my limbs. Now have ye heard all, and why I have to return to my solitude. Nothing have I kept hidden from you, my friends. But even this have ye heard from me, who is still the most reserved of men, and will be so. Ah, my friends, I should have something more to say unto you. I should have something more to give unto you. Why do I not give it? Am I then a niggard? When, however, Zarathustra had spoken these words, the violence of his pain, and a sense of the nearness of his departure from his friends, came over him, so that he wept aloud, and no one knew how to console him. In the night, however, he went away alone and left his friends. Third part. Ye look aloft when ye long for exaltation, and I look downward because I am exalted. Who among you can at the same time laugh and be exalted? He who climbeth on the highest mountains laugheth at all tragic plays and tragic realities. Zarathustra, 1. Reading and Writing. 45. The Wanderer. Then, when it was about midnight, Zarathustra went his way over the ridge of the isle, that he might arrive early in the morning at the other coast, because there he meant to embark. For there was a good roadstead there, in which foreign ships also liked to anchor. Those ships took many people with them, who wished to cross over from the Happy Isles. So when Zarathustra thus ascended the mountain, he thought on the way of his many solitary wanderings from youth onwards, and how many mountains and ridges and summits he had already climbed. I am a wanderer and mountain climber, said he to his heart. I love not the plains, and it seemeth I cannot long sit still. And whatever may still overtake me as fate and experience, a wandering will be therein, and a mountain climbing. In the end one experienceth only oneself. The time is now past when accidents could befall me, and what could now fall to my lot which would not already be mine own. It returneth only, it cometh home to me at last, mine own self, and such of it as hath been long abroad, and scattered among things and accidents. And one thing more do I know. I stand now before my last summit, and before that which hath been longest reserved for me. Ah, my hardest path must I ascend. Ah, I have begun my lonesomest wandering. He, however, who is of my nature, doth not avoid such an hour, the hour that saith unto him, Now only dost thou go the way to thy greatness, summit and abyss. These are now comprised together. Thou goest the way to thy greatness. Now hath it become thy last refuge, what was hitherto thy last danger. Thou goest the way to thy greatness. It must now be thy best courage that there is no longer any path behind thee. Thou goest the way to thy greatness. Here shall no one steal after thee. Thy foot itself hath effaced the path behind thee, and over it standeth written, Impossibility. And if all ladders henceforth fail thee, then must thou learn to mount upon thine own head. How couldst thou mount upward otherwise? Upon thine own head, and beyond thine own heart, now must the gentlest in thee become the hardest. He who hath always much indulged himself, sickeneth at last by his much indulgence, praises on what maketh hardy. I do not praise the land where butter and honey flow. To learn to look away from oneself is necessary in order to see many things. This hardiness is needed by every mountain climber. He, however, who is obtrusive with his eyes as a discerner, how can he ever see more of anything than its foreground? But thou, O Zarathustra, wouldst view the ground of everything, and its background. Thus must thou mount even above thyself, up, upwards, until thou hast even thy stars under thee. Yea, to look down upon myself, and even upon my stars, that only would I call my summit, that hath remained for me as my last summit. Thus spake Zarathustra to himself while ascending, comforting his heart with harsh maxims, for he was sore at heart as he had never been before. And when he had reached the top of the mountain ridge, behold, there lay the other sea spread out before him, and he stood still and was long silent. The night, however, was cold at this height, and clear and starry. I recognize my destiny, said he at last, sadly. Well, I am ready. Now hath my last lonesomeness begun. Ah, this sombre, sad sea below me! Ah, this sombre nocturnal vexation! Ah, fate and sea! To you must I now go down. Before my highest mountain do I stand, and before my longest wandering. Therefore must I first go deeper down than I ever ascended. Deeper down into pain than I ever ascended, even into its darkest flood. So willeth my fate. Well, I am ready. Whence come the highest mountains? So did I once ask. Then did I learn that they come out of the sea. That testimony is inscribed on their stones and on the walls of their summits. Out of the deepest must the highest come to its height. Thus spake Zarathustra on the ridge of the mountain where it was cold. When, however, he came into the vicinity of the sea, and at last stood alone amongst the cliffs, then had he become weary on his way, and eagerer than ever before. Everything as yet sleepeth, said he, even the sea sleepeth. Drowsily and strangely doth its eye gaze upon me. But it breatheth warmly, I feel it, and I feel also that it dreameth, it tosseth about dreamily on hard pillows. Hark, hark, how it groaneth with evil recollections, or evil expectations. Ah, I am sad along with thee, thou dusky monster, and angry with myself even for thy sake. Ah, that my hand hath not strength enough. Gladly indeed would I free thee from evil dreams. And while Zarathustra thus spake, He laughed at himself with melancholy and bitterness. "What, Zarathustra," said he, "wilt thou even sing consolation to the sea? Ah, thou amiable fool, Zarathustra, thou too blindly confiding one, but thus hast thou ever been, ever hast thou approached confidently all that is terrible. Every monster wouldst thou caress, a whiff of warm breath, a little soft tuft on its paw, and immediately wert thou ready to love and lure it. Love is the danger of the lonesomest one, love to anything, if it only live. Laughable, verily, is my folly and my modesty in love." Thus spake Zarathustra, and laughed thereby a second time. Then, however, he thought of his abandoned friends, and, as if he had done them a wrong with his thoughts, he upbraided himself because of his thoughts, and forthwith it came to pass that the laugher wept, with anger and longing wept Zarathustra bitterly. 46. The Vision and the Enigma. 1. When it got abroad among the sailors that Zarathustra was on board the ship, for a man who came from the Happy Isles had gone on board along with him, there was great curiosity and expectation. But Zarathustra kept silent for 2 days, and was cold and deaf with sadness, so that he neither answered looks nor questions. On the evening of the second day, however, he again opened his ears, though he still kept silent, for there were many curious and dangerous things to be heard on board the ship, which came from afar, and was to go still further. Zarathustra, however, was fond of all those who make distant voyages, and dislike to live without danger. And behold, when listening, his own tongue was at last loosened, and the ice of his heart broke. Then did he begin to speak thus: "To you, the daring venturers and adventurers, and whoever hath embarked with cunning sails upon frightful seas, to you the enigma intoxicated, the twilight enjoyers, whose souls are allured by flutes to every treacherous gulf. For ye dislike to grope at a thread with cowardly hand, and where ye can divine, there do ye hate to calculate. To you only do I tell the enigma that I saw, the vision of the lonesomest one. Gloomily walked I lately in corpse-coloured twilight, gloomily and sternly with compressed lips. Not only one sun had set for me. A path which ascended daringly among boulders, an evil, lonesome path, which neither herb nor shrub any longer cheered, a mountain path, crunched under the daring of my foot. Mutely marching over the scornful clinking of pebbles, trampling the stone that let it slip, thus did my foot force its way upwards. Upwards, in spite of the spirit that drew it downwards, towards the abyss, the spirit of gravity, my devil and arch-enemy. Upwards, although it sat upon me half-dwarf, half-mole, paralyzed, paralyzing, dripping lead in mine ear, and thoughts like drops of lead into my brain. "O Zarathustra," it whispered scornfully, syllable by syllable, "thou stone of wisdom, thou threwest thyself high, but every thrown stone must fall. O Zarathustra, thou stone of wisdom, thou sling stone, thou star destroyer, thyself threwest thou so high, but every thrown stone must fall. Condemned of thyself and to thine own stoning, O Zarathustra, far indeed threwest thou thy stone, but upon thyself will it recoil." Then was the dwarf silent, and it lasted long. The silence, however, oppressed me, and to be thus in pairs, one is verily lonesomer than when alone. I ascended, I dreamt, I thought, but everything oppressed me. A sick one did I resemble, whom bad torture wearieth, and a worse dream reawakeneth out of his first sleep. But there is something in me which I call courage. It hath hitherto slain for me every dejection. This courage at last bade me stand still and say, "Dwarf, thou or I." For courage is the best slayer, courage which attacketh, for in every attack there is sound of triumph. Man, however, is the most courageous animal. Thereby hath he overcome every animal. With sound of triumph hath he overcome every pain. Human pain, however, is the sorest pain. Courage slayeth also giddiness at abysses. And where doth man not stand at abysses? Is not seeing itself seeing abysses? Courage is the best slayer. Courage slayeth also fellow suffering. Fellow suffering, however, is the deepest abyss. As deeply as man looketh into life, so deeply also doth he look into suffering. Courage, however, is the best slayer. Courage, which attacketh, it slayeth even death itself, for it saith, Was that life? Well, once more. In such speech, however, there is much sound of triumph. He who hath ears to hear, let him hear. 2. Halt, dwarf, said I, either I or thou. I, however, am the stronger of the two. Thou knowest not mine abysmal thought. It couldst thou not endure. Then happened that which made me lighter, for the dwarf sprang from my shoulder, the prying sprite, and it squatted on a stone in front of me. There was, however, a gateway just where we halted. Look at this gateway, dwarf, I continued. It hath two faces. Two roads come together here. These hath no one yet gone to the end of. This long lane backwards, it continueth for an eternity, and that long lane forward, that is another eternity. They are antithetical to one another, these roads. They directly abut on one another, and it is here at this gateway that they come together. The name of the gateway is inscribed above, this moment. But should one follow them further, and even further and further on, thinkest thou, dwarf, that these roads would be eternally antithetical? Everything straight lieth, murmured the dwarf contemptuously. All truth is crooked. Time itself is a circle. Thou spirit of gravity, said I wrathfully, do not take it too lightly, or I shall let thee squat where thou squattest, halt-foot, and I carry thee high. Observe, continued I, this moment, from the gateway this moment, there runneth a long eternal lane backwards. Behind us lieth an eternity. Must not whatever can run its course of all things have already run along that lane? Must not whatever can happen of all things have already happened, resulted, and gone by? And if everything have already existed, what thinkest thou, dwarf, of this moment? Must not this gateway also have already existed? And are not all things closely bound together in such wise that this moment draweth all coming things after it, consequently itself also? For whatever can run its course of all things, also in this long lane outward, must it once more run. And this slow spider which creepeth in the moonlight, and this moonlight itself, and thou and I in this gateway whispering together, whispering of eternal things, must we not all have already existed? And must we not return and run in that other lane out before us, that long, weird lane? Must we not eternally return? Thus did I speak, and always more softly, for I was afraid of my own thoughts and arrear thoughts. Then suddenly did I hear a dog howl near me. Had I ever heard a dog howl thus? My thoughts ran back. Yes, when I was a child, in my most distant childhood. Then did I hear a dog howl thus, and saw it also, with hair bristling its head upwards, trembling in the stillest midnight, when even dogs believe in ghosts. So that it excited my commiseration. For just then went the full moon, silent as death, over the house. Just then did it stand still, a glowing globe, at rest on the flat roof, as if on someone's property. Thereby had the dog been terrified, for dogs believe in thieves and ghosts. And when I again heard such howling, then did it excite my commiseration once more. Where was now the dwarf, and the gateway, and the spider, and all the whispering? Had I dreamt? Had I awakened? Twixt rugged rocks did I suddenly stand alone, dreary in the dreariest moonlight. But there lay a man, and there, the dog leaping, bristling, whining. Now did it see me coming, then did it howl again, then did it cry. Had I ever heard a dog cry so for help? And verily what I saw, the like had I never seen. A young shepherd did I see, writhing, choking, quivering with a distorted countenance, and with a heavy black serpent hanging out of his mouth. Had I ever seen so much loathing and pale horror on one countenance? He had perhaps gone to sleep? Then had the serpent crawled into his throat. There had it bitten itself fast. My hand pulled at the serpent and pulled, in vain. I failed to pull the serpent out of his throat. Then there cried out of me, "Bite! Bite!" "Its head off! Bite!" So cried it out of me. My horror, my hatred, my loathing, my pity, all my good and my bad cried with one voice out of me. Ye daring ones around me, ye venturers and adventurers, and whoever of you have embarked with cunning sails on unexplored seas, ye enigma enjoyers, solve unto me the enigma that I then beheld, interpret unto me the vision of the lonesomest one. For it was a vision and a foresight. What did I then behold in parable, and who is it that must come some day? Who is the shepherd into whose throat the serpent thus crawled? Who is the man into whose throat all the heaviest and blackest will thus crawl? The shepherd, however, bit, as my cry had admonished him. He bit with a strong bite. Far away did he spit the head of the serpent, and sprang up. No longer shepherd, no longer man. A transfigured being, a light-surrounded being that laughed. Never on earth laughed a man as he laughed. Oh, my brethren, I heard a laughter which was no human laughter, and now gnaweth a thirst at me, a longing that is never allayed. My longing for that laughter gnaweth at me. Oh, how can I still endure to live, and how could I endure to die at present? Thus spake Zarathustra. 47. Involuntary Bliss. With such enigmas and bitterness in his heart did Zarathustra sail o'er the sea. When, however, he was 4 day journeys from the Happy Isles and from his friends, then had he surmounted all his pain. Triumphantly and with firm foot did he again accept his fate, and then talked Zarathustra in this wise to his exulting conscience. Alone am I again, and like to be so. Alone with the pure heaven and the open sea, and again is the afternoon around me. On an afternoon did I find my friends for the first time. On an afternoon also did I find them a second time, at the hour when all light becometh stiller. For whatever happiness is still on its way twixt heaven and earth, now seeketh for lodging a luminous soul. With happiness hath all light now become stiller. O afternoon of my life! Once did my happiness also descend to the valley, that it might seek a lodging. Then did it find those open, hospitable souls. O afternoon of my life! What did I not surrender that I might have one thing, this living plantation of my thoughts, and this dawn of my highest hope? Companions did the Creating One once seek, and children of his hope. And lo, it turned out that he could not find them, except he himself should first create them. Thus am I in the midst of my work, to my children going, and from them returning. For the sake of his children must Zarathustra perfect himself. For in one's heart one loveth only one's child and one's work, and where there is great love to oneself, then is it the sign of pregnancy. So have I found it. Still are my children verdant in their first spring, standing nigh one another, and shaken in common by the winds, the trees of my garden and of my best soil. And verily, where such trees stand beside one another, there are happy isles. But one day will I take them up, and put each by itself alone, that it may learn lonesomeness and defiance and prudence. Gnarled and crooked, and with flexible hardness shall it then stand by the sea, a living lighthouse of unconquerable life. Yonder, where the storms rush down into the sea, and the snout of the mountain drinketh water, shall each on a time have his day and night watches, for his testing and recognition. Recognized and tested shall each be, to see if he be of my type and lineage, if he be master of a long will, silent even when he speaketh, and giving in such wise that he taketh in giving, so that he may one day become my companion, a fellow creator and fellow enjoyer with Zarathustra, such a one as writeth my will on my tables for the fuller perfection of all things. And for his sake, and for those like him, must I perfect myself. Therefore do I now avoid my happiness, and present myself to every misfortune, for my final testing and recognition. And verily, it were time that I went away, and the wanderer's shadow, and the longest tedium, and the stillest hour, have all said unto me, it is the highest time. The word blew to me through the keyhole, and said, Come. The door sprang subtly open unto me, and said, Go. But I lay enchained to my love for my children. Desire spread this snare for me, the desire for love, that I should become the prey of my children and lose myself in them. Desiring, that is now for me to have lost myself. I possess you, my children. In this possessing shall everything be assurance, and nothing desire. But brooding lay the son of my love upon me, in his own juice stewed Zarathustra. Then did shadows and doubts fly past me. For frost and winter I now longed. Oh, that frost and winter would again make me crack and crunch, sighed I. Then arose icy mist out of me. My past burst its tomb. Many pains, buried alive, woke up. Fully slept, had they merely, concealed in corpse clothes. So called everything unto me in signs. It is time. But I heard not, until at last mine abyss moved, and my thought bit me. Ah, abysmal thought, which art my thought? When shall I find strength to hear thee burrowing and no longer tremble? To my very throat throbbeth my heart when I hear thee burrowing. Thy muteness even is like to strangle me, thou abysmal mute one. As yet have I never ventured to call thee up. It hath been enough that I have carried thee about with me. As yet have I not been strong enough for my final lion wantonness and playfulness. Sufficiently formidable unto me hath thy weight ever been, but one day shall I yet find the strength and the lion's voice which will call thee up. When I shall have surmounted myself therein, then will I surmount myself also in that which is greater, and a victory shall be the seal of my perfection. Meanwhile do I sail along on uncertain seas. Chance flattereth me, smooth-tongued chance. Forward and backward do I gaze. Still see I no end. And yet hath the hour of my final struggle not come to me, or doth it come to me perhaps just now? Verily, with insidious beauty do sea and life gaze upon me round about. O afternoon of my life! O happiness before eventide! O haven upon high seas, O peace in uncertainty, how I distrust all of you. Verily distrustful am I of your insidious beauty, like the lover am I, who distrusteth too sleek smiling. As he pusheth the best beloved before him, tender even in severity, the jealous one, so do I push this blissful hour before me. Away with thee, thou blissful hour! With thee hath there come to me an involuntary bliss. Ready for my severest pain do I here stand. At the wrong time hast thou come. Away with thee, thou blissful hour! Rather harbour there with my children. Hasten and bless them before eventide with my happiness. There already approacheth eventide. The sun sinketh. Away, my happiness! Thus spake Zarathustra. And he waited for his misfortune the whole night, but he waited in vain. The night remained clear and calm, and happiness itself came nigher and nigher unto him. Towards morning, however, Zarathustra laughed to his heart and said mockingly, Happiness runneth after me. That is because I do not run after women. Happiness, however, is a woman. 48. Before Sunrise. O heaven above me, thou pure, thou deep heaven, thou abyss of light, gazing on thee I tremble with divine desires. Up to thy height to toss myself, that is my depth. In thy purity to hide myself, that is mine innocence. The God veileth his beauty, thus hidest thou thy stars. Thou speakest not thus, proclaimest thou thy wisdom unto me. Mute o'er the raging sea hast thou risen for me today. Thy love and thy modesty make a revelation unto my raging soul. In that thou camest unto me beautiful, veiled in thy beauty, in that thou spakest unto me mutely, obvious in thy wisdom. Oh, how could I fail to divine all the modesty of thy soul? Before the sun didst thou come unto me, the lonesomest one. We have been friends from the beginning. To us are grief, gruesomeness, and ground common. Even the sun is common to us. We do not speak to each other because we know too much. We keep silent to each other. We smile our knowledge to each other. Art thou not the light of my fire? Hast thou not the sister soul of mine insight? Together did we learn everything. Together did we learn to ascend beyond ourselves to ourselves, and to smile uncloudedly. Uncloudedly to smile down out of luminous eyes, and out of miles of distance, when under us constraint and purpose and guilt steam like rain. And wandered I alone, for what did my soul hunger by night, and in labyrinthine paths, and climbed I mountains? Whom did I ever seek, if not thee, upon mountains? And all my wandering and mountain-climbing, a necessity was it merely, and a makeshift of the unhandy one. To fly only wanteth mine entire will, to fly into thee. And what have I hated more than passing clouds, and whatever tainteth thee? And mine own hatred have I even hated, because it tainted thee. The passing clouds I detest, those stealthy cats of prey, they take from thee and me what is common to us, the vast unbounded yea and amen saying. These mediators and mixers we detest, the passing clouds, those half and half ones that have neither learned to bless nor to curse from the heart. Rather will I sit in a tub under a closed heaven, rather will I sit in the abyss without heaven than see thee, thou luminous heaven, tainted with passing clouds. And oft have I longed to pin them fast with the jagged gold wires of lightning, that I might, like the thunder, beat the drum upon their kettle bellies. An angry drummer, because they rob me of thy yea and amen. Thou heaven above me, thou pure, thou luminous heaven, thou abyss of light, because they rob thee of my yea and amen. For rather will I have noise and thunders and tempest blasts than this discreet doubting cat repose, and also amongst men do I hate most of all the soft treaders and half ones, and the doubting, hesitating, passing clouds. And he who cannot bless shall learn to curse, this clear teaching dropped unto me from the clear heaven, this star standeth in my heaven even in dark nights. I, however, am a blesser and a yea-sayer, if thou be but around me, thou pure, thou luminous heaven, thou abyss of light, into all abysses do I then carry my beneficent yea-saying. A blesser have I become and a yea-sayer, and therefore strove I long and was a striver, that I might one day get my hands free for blessing. This, however, is my blessing, to stand above everything as its own heaven, its round roof, its azure bell and eternal security, and blessed is he who thus blesseth. For all things are baptized at the font of eternity, and beyond good and evil. Good and evil themselves, however, are but fugitive shadows and damp afflictions and passing clouds. Verily it is a blessing and not a blasphemy when I teach that, above all things, there standeth the heaven of chance, the heaven of innocence, the heaven of hazard, the heaven of wantonness. Of hazard, that is the oldest nobility in the world. That gave I back to all things. I emancipated them from bondage under purpose. This freedom and celestial serenity did I put like an azure bell above all things, when I taught that over them and through them no eternal willeth. This wantonness and folly did I put in place of that will, when I taught that in everything there is one thing impossible, rationality. A little reason, to be sure, a germ of wisdom scattered from star to star. This leaven is mixed in all things. For the sake of folly, wisdom is mixed in all things. A little wisdom is indeed possible, but this blessed security have I found in all things, that they prefer to dance on the feet of chance. O heaven above me, thou pure, thou lofty heaven, this is now thy purity unto me, that there is no eternal reason spider and reason cobweb. That thou art to me a dancing floor for divine chances, that thou art to me a table of the gods for divine dice and dice players. But thou blushest? Have I spoken unspeakable things? Have I abused when I meant to bless thee? Or is it the shame of being two of us that maketh thee blush? Dost thou bid me go and be silent because now day cometh? The world is deep, and deeper than e'er the day could read. Not everything may be uttered in presence of day, but day cometh, so let us part. O heaven above me, thou modest one, thou glowing one, O thou my happiness before sunrise, the day cometh, so let us part. Thus spake Zarathustra. 49. The Bedwarfing Virtue. 1. When Zarathustra was again on the continent, he did not go straightway to his mountain and his cave, but made many wanderings and questionings, and ascertained this and that, so that he said of himself jestingly, Lo, a river that floweth back unto its source in many windings, for he wanted to learn what had taken place among men during the interval, whether they had become greater or smaller. And once, when he saw a row of new houses, he marvelled and said, What do these houses mean? Verily no great soul put them up as its simile. Did perhaps a silly child take them out of its toy box? Would that another child put them again into the box? And these rooms and chambers, can men go out and in there? They seem to be made for silk dolls, or for dainty eaters, who perhaps let others eat with them. And Zarathustra stood still and meditated. At last he said sorrowfully, There hath everything become smaller. Everywhere do I see lower doorways. He who is of my type can still go there through, but he must stoop. Oh, when shall I arrive again at my home, where I shall no longer have to stoop, shall no longer have to stoop before the small ones? And Zarathustra sighed and gazed into the distance. The same day, however, he gave his discourse on the bedwarfing virtue. 2. I pass through this people and keep mine eyes open. They do not forgive me for not envying their virtues. They bite at me, because I say unto them that for small people small virtues are necessary, and because it is hard for me to understand that small people are necessary. Here am I still like a cock in a strange farmyard, at which even the hens peck, but on that account I am not unfriendly to the hens. I am courteous towards them, as towards all small annoyances. To be prickly towards what is small seemeth to me wisdom for hedgehogs. They all speak of me when they sit around their fire in the evening. They speak of me, but no one thinketh of me. This is the new stillness which I have experienced. Their noise around me spreadeth a mantle over my thoughts. They shout to one another, What is this gloomy cloud about to do to us? Let us see that it doth not bring a plague upon us. And recently did a woman seize upon her child that was coming unto me. Take the children away, cried she. Such eyes scorch children's souls. They cough when I speak. They think coughing an objection to strong winds. They divine nothing of the boisterousness of my happiness. We have not yet time for Zarathustra, so they object. But what matter about a time that hath no time for Zarathustra? And if they should altogether praise me, how could I go to sleep on their praise? A girdle of spines is their praise unto me. It scratcheth me even when I take it off. And this also did I learn among them, the praiser doeth as if he gave back. In truth, however, he wanteth more to be given him. Ask my foot if their lording and luring strains please it. Verily to such measure and tick-tack it like